Well, today I'm not going to really do what I've been doing up until now. I've been doing basically Bible studies on a man's having more than one wife. But since we're talking about the subject of marriage, I want to dwell on that issue a little bit. In fact, what I'm going to do here today is I'm going to give you a legal presentation on the marriage license, the state-issued marriage license, and what kind of effects this thing has upon you. Now, we all have heard the expression, you know, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. Well, I'm going to title this, I guess I was going to put a title to this particular talk that I'm doing today. I would say, what the state has joined together, the state controls. What the state has joined together, the state controls. In other words, what we're talking about here is a hidden third party in your marriage. You have a hidden third party in your marriage, and it's called the state. Now, this is everything that I'm going to tell you is based on legalese, I guess you could say. It's a matter of law. It's a matter of law. That's just the way it is. It doesn't really matter how we feel about these things. This is a matter of law. So the purpose of today's discussion, then, is to explain the history and the effects of a state-issued marriage license. But before I get into a discussion regarding marriage licenses, there's a couple things that we need to know. And these are definitions of a couple of words. And I'll do some more of this later on. But before I can even get started, you have to know a couple of these things. So permission is the first one on that interests me. And the permission is defined. Now, this comes to us out of Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition, page 1026, if you're interested. Permission is defined as, quote, a license to do a thing, an authority to do an act, which without proper authority would have been unlawful. Now, that's legalese, I understand, but anything that's unlawful to do requires a license to do it. That's what it really amounts to. Now, you may have noticed that it's always the state who issues these things called licenses. I guess the county issue permits and things like that, but basically our marriage license and driver's license and things like that are issued by the state. And what this above definition tells us then is that permission of the state is granted in the form of a license. So since they're granting a license, we need to know what a license is. What is the definition of a license? And again, I'm going to Black's Law Dictionary to give you the definition of this. On this time, it's page 829. A license is defined as, quote, the permission by competent authority to do an act which without such permission would be illegal, a trespass, or a tort. Now, this is a little legalese when we get to a trespass. Without such permission would be illegal, a trespass, or a tort. Anything illegal would, of course, be anything that's in violation of state law. A trespass is when you violate somebody's rights, and a tort would be when you damage somebody. You would normally file a tort claim under the old law. But anyhow, since all states require those intending to marry to apply for a license, then the state is granting its permission for this particular marriage to take place. But by definition, what this really means is marriage without permission of the state is considered unlawful. It's illegal. It's a trespass. It's a tort. Now, this is what they're telling you by law. Now, I know that there's people that marry themselves without permission by the state, but I'm talking about when you petition the state now, you're getting a state marriage license. It may be issued by the county or whatever, but you're getting a marriage license. You're asking permission to marry is what you're really doing, see. But anyhow, with this definition, it leads us to actually what I would call a false conclusion, because prior to the existence of the state, there was no legal marriages, if that be the case. You know, marriages were simply illegal. But it's unquestioned, though, that a marriage is a form of a contract. We normally consider that contract between two people. And when you bring God into the picture, then you'd bring the third party into the contract, if you're religious. But people used to marry all the time who were not religious, and it was simply an agreement between the two of them. They saw each other, they met, and they back in the old days, the Western days, I mean, that was about it. They didn't have, well, they had some roving preachers, but they didn't have time to be looking up somebody to marry them, you know, or get permission. I want to read to you from a court case. This one comes to us from a court case called Willits versus Willits. It's found in the Northwestern Reporter, 107 Northwest 379-380, as a matter of fact. This is the Supreme Court of Nebraska, and it says this. If, and it's talking about the marriage now, It differs from all other contracts in its far-reaching consequences to the body politic itself, and for that reason, in dealing with it or the statutes resulting therefrom, the state never stands indifferent, but is always a party whose interest must be taken into account. So this is the license to steal from you, is what it really amounts to. But the question is, even though a marriage, though, is a contract, why does the state never stand indifferent to it? Why would that be? And just how did the state become a party whose interest must always be taken into account when we're talking about marriage? For example, though, what possible interest has the state in the status of marriage partners who wish to separate? We should look at that from the other thing. Why would they be interested in you marrying somebody in the first place? But in order to control the interest of a person who wants to separate marriages, then they must be the issuing party. Well, they don't have to be, but if they've issued the license, then they're the one that's going to monitor the separation of the license or the contract. Okay, so there's twofold reasons, anyhow, basically, that they are interested in a marriage splitting up. And they are. Number one, the state claims to have an interest in seeing that the wife and any children do not become a financial burden to the state. Number two, the state claims to have an interest in seeing that any children are educated to the satisfaction of the state. Now, the same court, this Willits versus Willits, substantiates this, what I'm just telling you here in part, by stating this, and this is a quote again out of that court case. Public policy, which requires courts jealously to guard the rights of infants and take due precautions to prevent their becoming a public charge. And while we're on the subject of marriage and divorce here, I would disagree with the United States Supreme Court, which had this to say about it. This comes to a case called Maynard versus Hill. When the contract to marry is executed by the marriage, a relation between the parties is created which they cannot change. The relation once formed, the law steps in and holds the parties to various obligations and liabilities. Well, what a ruling that is. Is that a ruling that's kind of tyrannical, or is it not? But if this were true, then the marriage contract is the only contract we know of which cannot be changed or altered or done away with the consent of both parties who made the contract. But be that as it may, in the Maynard case, the court quoted a Maine case which had this to say, and again, this is a quote. This comes from Adams versus Palmer. It's a Maine case. I don't have the date on it, but it is quoted in Maynard versus Hill. It says, when the contracting parties have entered into the marriage state, they have not so much entered into a contract as a new relation, the rights, the duties, and the obligations of which rest not upon their agreement, but upon the general law of the state, statutory or common, which defines and prescribes those rights, duties, and obligations. They are of law, not contract. Okay, so what they're saying is marriage is not a contract, and your marriage is actually bound by law. Well, now, if your marriage is bound by law, then you've got to have the marriage license. At least that would be my supposition, because I've got to have some way to hold you to their statutes. And so if you're married, you've got to obey the statutes. It's like the driver's license. You know, the reason you have to obey all the driving laws is because you got a license. And if you break the terms of the contract, then we're going to fine you and penalize you, put you in jail or whatever. But anyhow, what the court said here is very interesting, because the court is saying that even though two parties entered into a contract between themselves, that would be our position at least, what the provisions of that contract are is determined by the state, not the contracting parties. Now, isn't that interesting? And this being the case, though, if a couple intending to marry make up their own private contract and made certain provisions in that contract and both signed that contract, and if it had been witnessed, those provisions would be null and void if they conflict with the general law of the state. So you can do these contractual things up to a point, but if it conflicts with the general law of the state, it won't hold any water. The state will not recognize it. So what the state is obviously referring to here would be the statutory laws of that particular state. Absolutely. But from our perspective, or at least my perspective, negation of a private contract by state law is absurd. That would be my position. Anytime that I entered into a contract with somebody and the state can come along and say, hey, that contract's no good, you know, then I haven't really made a contract. You know, that just doesn't make any sense. Now, how many people want, I should rephrase it, how many married people, because we're talking about married people, how many married people want the state to determine what our duties, what our obligations, and what our liabilities toward each other and our family are? I mean, if the state can determine what the duties, obligations, and liabilities of married people are toward each other, then the state can do things, for instance, like pass laws that require us to apply for and get a license before we can bear children. Yeah, that's right. If they can do that, if they can determine our duties, obligations, and liabilities as married couples, then they can pass a law requiring us to get a license before we bear children. They certainly can do that. They got the power to do one, they got the power to do the other. And some of you might say, well, that's impossible. They'd never do that. Hey, wait a minute. Let me tell you something. You're going to really enjoy this. Five state legislatures during the year 1994-1995, hey, folks, that's what, 5 years ago? Introduced this kind of legislation. It never became law, but it was introduced. And that's important. Because you know how these things work. What they introduce today and gets rejected gets introduced tomorrow, and maybe it gets rejected again, but eventually it will pass. You know, it's like those revenue-raising things that the schools put out when they need more money for some new school or something. They get vetoed, vetoed, and vetoed, and vetoed, and by the fourth, fifth time around, after 6 months, people just get tired of voting, except those who want the school, and they get their bond. And then everybody has to pay. Kind of the same way. But anyhow, if the legislatures assume that kind of power over marital duties, obligations, and liabilities, they have the power to regulate every stinking aspect of marital life to include sexual frequency. That's right. If they've got that kind of power to do those things, they can regulate in total. Whether they do it or not is always another question. Now, the question arises in my mind is, from whom did people get permission to marry, and who had an interest in the family before the existence of the state? Now, does this question make you ask what government existed to license and regulate Adam and Eve? And what law of man governed their duties and their obligations and their responsibilities toward each other and to the society that later existed? What law of man governed that? Now, I ask these questions because apparently the state is assuming the pre-existence of government to man. Isn't that what they're doing? Well, they're certainly saying that today. You know, we exist before you do. Our interests come before your interests. And so what government has done then has made itself the creator of man. Well, how did they do such a thing? Well, they did it with a birth certificate. That's the evidence of your creation. I mean, you may have done this with some other thing through God and having sexual relationships and then gave birth, but when you got that birth certificate, that's evidence, again, of your registration. It's just like a car. When a car is first manufactured, there's a thing called a bill of origin, I think it's called. That's the title to the car. And when you buy that car, this title of origin goes to the state. The state keeps the title of origin, and they give you a certificate to title. Not the title, but a certificate to title. So they've given you a certificate, a birth certificate, that you exist. And they're claiming to be the sole creator of you. That's just the way it works in law. So anyhow, the government has made itself the creator of man as well as the creator of marriage, because a marriage license is the evidence of that creation. And so therefore it's made itself as God, hasn't it? Of course, I've said that time and time again. Now, based upon the state passing such laws, it has required the courts to assume a power under what we call a fiction of law. That's a power that never pre-existed. Now, where am I? Okay. Going back to the Bible for a minute, from a biblical perspective then, marriage, though, was instituted by God. I mean, we assume that from the relationship that we see in Adam and Eve, even though there wasn't really a formal ceremony. We just saw that God made Eve and brought her to the man. And so we're calling that the marriage. And we've seen that a marriage is really nothing more than sexual cohabitation, by definition, from a biblical standpoint. But anyhow, there's many reasons for this, and we have to read or assume that we know what God intended here, but as we look at the situation between man and woman, we say that God instituted this marriage thing for the purpose of preventing people from being promiscuous, for promoting happiness among people, for securing the maintenance and the education of children, as well as to satisfy, of course, this uncontrollable sex urge of man. And I think that it's self-evident that marriage existed long before the creation of any state anywhere. And we even know that from our own United States history. You know, we had territories out here, but, you know, there was nobody issuing marriage licenses in the early history of the West. Now, in searching the scriptures, we fail to find anywhere that God talked about marriage and gave any rights to the state to regulate or control marriages. That just didn't happen, did it? Marriage has always been a function, ecclesiastical type function, from a religious point of view. And it was never a state issue until the state got involved in it, brought themselves into the equation. Now, we did find, or do find, I should say, that in Genesis chapter 2:18, the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone." And so he was going to make this helpmate for him. And we've been through this before. And in Genesis 2, verse 24, we've read that, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Then we find other references to this family relationship, like in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 9 and 10, where it says, "Teach them thy sons and thy sons' sons." And the other one says, "Teach their children." So one of the responsibilities then of a marriage is to teach your children. We find a like thing in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 7. "And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children." We're talking about the laws of God here. Okay, so it's a family responsibility, a mother and father's responsibility to educate your children. But see, the state here, remember what I read to you back in the beginning? This was a, what was it? I see, let me go back here. The state claims to have an interest in seeing that any children are education to the satisfaction of the state. That's right. So since they have that interest, they want to make sure that their children are educated in their schools, see, so they can tax you for it, I guess. I don't know. But anyhow, biblically, that is a responsibility of the family, not the state. Now, once again, from a biblical standpoint, God, not the state, created Adam. And God, not the state, made a helpmeet for Adam. And God, not the state, created this concept of marriage. And if there's a third party to the marriage contract, the third party of interest is God, not the state. Now, need I mention the fact that it is beyond the capacity of the state to create man, woman, or marriages? It's beyond their capacity. They do it. I mean, they claim to have done it. I mean, they don't really claim that. They just do it by the paperwork that they require, which tells us that they're doing it. Nor can the state protect us from God's judgments. And therefore, the state has no right to regulate the duties, obligations, and liabilities of marriage. Now, that's coming from a biblical perspective. That's coming from a church perspective, if you will. If I had my church, this is what I'd want my people in the congregation to know. Now, these children we talked about, that's the fruits of the marriage. And they are the property of their creator, and their creator is God, not the state, nor even the parents for that matter. Because we've already seen in looking at Jacob's case with Rachel and Leah, that it was God who opened the wombs of these women. He allowed the creation of these children. It was not the relationship. The relationship, of course, allowed it to come to pass, but it was God that allowed that union of that seed and the sperm to come to pass, so that there would be a child, see. And nowhere in Scripture does it state that children are the property of the parents. Nor does Scripture make any provisions for the state to have any control over God's children. Just isn't there. Children can only be created by a man and a woman by and through the will of God, who created marriage as well as the children. However, we usurp... excuse me. We have actually usurped the Word of God here. But parents are charged with the upbringing of their children, to include their religious and social education. And so we've delegated or given the state, you know, the right to bring up our children in the social environment in these public school systems. And there they learn things like humanism, see, rather than things about God. But they were to be commanded to teach thy sons and teach thy children the laws of God. You could do that if you're teaching your children, but once you send them to the government schools is not going to teach your children anything about God. They're going to teach you everything that they're actually going to teach you that there is no God. Indirectly, again, they're not going to say that. Okay, so where then did the state requirement for a license come into existence? Well, for the answer to this question, we've got to look at another legal definition of marriage license, which is defined as, listen to this now, it's right out of Black's Law Dictionary again. A marriage license is a license or permission granted by public authority to persons who intend to intermarry. By statute, it is made an essential prerequisite to the lawful solemnization of the intermarriage. Oh, did you notice that? The marriage license was issued to those who intend to intermarry. And this definition omits those who do not intend to intermarry. Now, what's intermarry? Well, I think we know the obvious answer to that, but if you go even to Black's Law Dictionary, under the word intermarriage, it refers the reader to miscegenation, you know, which is defined as mixture of the races, marriage between persons of different races, as between a white person and a Negro. That's right out of Black's Law Dictionary, page 901. Now, from these definitions, we can only conclude that the words intermarry and intermarriage refer to a mixing of the races, right? But where would this kind of logic enter into our American law? Well, let's stop and think about it. Were not our forefathers basically white Christian Europeans? And didn't they understand Scripture as well as the civil law? Did they not establish governments using the law of God as their model? Could they have read and could they possibly have understood in the verses in Deuteronomy where God commanded his people not to intermarry? Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 3. Neither shall thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shall thou take unto thy son. See? The them being referred to in this particular case were Canaanites, the descendants of Ham through Cain. Now later on in Ezra and Nehemiah, Nehemiah 13, verses 23, 25, and 27, it says, here in those days also I saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and Moab, and I contended them and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair and made them swear my God, saying, ye shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons or for yourselves. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress our God in marrying strange wives? Ezra 9, verse 2. For they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of princes and rulers have been chief in this trespass. Now the people of Ammon and Moab were the descendants of Lot through his two daughters, weren't they? Who gave him wine and seduced him following the destruction of Sodom. Now anyone who has read any of the early laws of the colonies knows that our founding fathers knew more about God's law than most people do today. And they did their best to obey God's laws. And this fact, I think, makes it easiest for us to understand how the state made laws prohibiting the intermarriage of different races. But as time marched on, it became inevitable that the state could not totally prohibit interracial marriages. And so a solution to the problem was needed. But on the other hand, the state did not want to condone intermarriage, which they had already made illegal. Now keep in mind that a license is defined as permission by competent authority to do an act which, without permission, would be illegal, a trespass, or a tort. And this definition solved their problem. Because since intermarriage was illegal, then the way around the prohibition was to issue licenses for mixed marriages. You see how easy that is? And of course, if you're going to issue a license for somebody to do something which is unlawful, you need to keep track of the number of people and who they are that you've allowed break the law. So they need to be recorded. And in order for the state to record a marriage, then there must be some document which would be the evidence needed by the intermarried couple to prove that they were not in violation of the law. Hey, we're black and white, and we're not supposed to do this, but we've got permission of the state. If you didn't have that piece of paper, you might be in serious trouble, see? And presto, the marriage license. Now, since a license is a grant of permission to do that which is otherwise unlawful, and since the state is the issuing power of the license, it is only logical that the state should record all these unlawful practices going on out there, which they did. Of course, it's an easy transition from licensing of mixed marriages to licensing of all marriages. It just creeps over time. It just follows that this would happen. As a matter of law, then, a license is quasi what we call quasi-contractual in nature, And as such, a marriage license has the effect of enfranchising the marriage. Now, what do I mean by enfranchising? You create kind of a corporation, a corporate entity. So you create a man, a woman, and you have the state involved. It's a three-way contract. And so that means then that a licensed marriage, like a corporation, is a creature of the state and subject to its rules and regulations. And this is true because as a matter of law, anything the state creates, it can regulate. Anything the state creates, it can subsidize and control, and it can tax it right out of existence if it desires to do so, because it's a creation of the state. And so no wonder the state assumes power to dissolve marriage contracts without a jury trial. Now, there's never in the history of our country been a jury trial for dissolving a marriage contract. You have a contractual problem, you know, with your plumber or something like this, or in construction of a home, and you're going to go to court, and if he demands a jury, you're going to have a jury, but not in a dissolving a marriage. So it's no wonder then also that the state disposes of the property of the marriage estates in its probate courts. And no wonder the state requires its children to be educated in its schools, or at least schools approved by the state. And no wonder the police powers of the state either regulate or tax everything that we do. No wonder the state invades the privacy of the home to inspect its children. They can do these things because the marriage license creates a quasi-corporate entity. And so no wonder has the state become the master and we have become the servile lords of the state, our God. Everybody bow down humbly before your God. God is your state. This also means that those who have the state's permission to marry in the form of a license have voluntarily contracted their individual rights associated with that marriage away, because with the licensing power goes the power of regulation. And once we voluntarily apply for and accept the license, then the state has the physical evidence in the license of the change in our status. And since we have now received from something from the state, it follows that we owe something to the state. Does that make sense to you? It doesn't? Well, it is that way. That's a matter of law. We have now received something from the state, it follows that we owe something to the state. And this principle law is found in a court case called Hale versus Hinkle. Hale versus Hinkle. And this was a Supreme Court of the United States case. Now listen to this. It's not talking about marriage, but it's still what's said here applies to a contractual arrangement or a quasi-corporate type entity. Now this is quite long, but it's very important. It says, we are of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter, that's the corporation, has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. The individual, see, there's a difference between an individual and a corporation. Now they're addressing the individual. The individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. He is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. His power to contract is unlimited. He owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or to open his doors to an investigation, so far as it may tend to incriminate him. He owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom. Let me repeat that. He owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom beyond the protection of life and property. I got to stop there. He receives nothing from the state beyond the protection of his life and property. That's what the state owes him. The state is there to protect our life and property, and that's its sole purpose. Anyhow, going on, he says, the court says, that is, Supreme Court of the United States now, his rights are such, we're talking about the individual, his rights are such as existed by the law of the land long antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. Among his rights are a refusal to incriminate himself and the immunity of himself and his property from arrest or seizure except under warrant of law. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon her rights. And boy, if this isn't true, this is true. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon their rights. Okay. On the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state. It is presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. It receives certain special privileges and franchises and holds them subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of its charter. Its rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creation. Got to stop there. Folks, this is law I'm reading to you. This is United States Supreme Court, and they understand exactly what they're saying, and so do I, and so should you. This is the way it is. Now, one more paragraph from the Supreme Court, Hale versus Hinkle, page 74 and 75, 201 U.S. 43. Quoting again, there is a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts. We're talking about the corporation, to investigate its contracts and find out whether it's exceeded its powers. It would be a strange anomaly to hold that the state, having chartered a corporation to make use of certain franchises, could not, in the exercise of its sovereignty, inquire how those franchises have been employed and whether they had been abused, and demand the protection of the corporate production, and demand the production of the corporate books and papers for that purpose. See, this was a search and seizure case, the taking of documents from the corporation. And the Supreme Court is saying, hey, it's a corporation. It's licensed by the state. It's created by the state. The state can do what it wants to with it. And if you read enough court cases, you'll find out that they can totally wipe that corporation out by the taxes. They did it to banks back in the Midwest somewhere. It's called DZ Bank. Now, I would hope that you find this particular information in the Supreme Court case very valuable information. Based upon that decision, it follows that any person or persons receiving a license which has been issued by the state, be it marriage license or driving license, comes under the Hale Doctrine, and that makes that person or persons as controllable as a corporation. Just the way it is, folks. But it was not always that way. Because prior to the time the state requirement for licensing exists, marriages were contracts entered into between male and female. They were entered into under the power or right granted to them by God. In other words, for religious people, marriage was not a state issue, but a religious issue, and it should be that way today. Now, from a legal perspective, a marriage licensed by the state is a marriage granted by the state and becomes a three-party contract between the state, the husband, and the wife, and that's why the state is never indifferent to the separation. And since the state is the creator of the marriage, it is also creator or the owner of the fruit of that marriage, just like Sarah was her handmaiden. Therefore, it follows that the children and the labor and the property that accumulates as a result of that marriage are subject to state regulation and control. Matter of law, folks. I don't want you to take what I'm saying here too lightly. Don't shake your head at me. Because many years ago, Pastor Sullivan's church school was shut down in the state of Nebraska. And members of that congregation were up testifying before a committee in the state house. And one woman pleaded that these were our children and that they had the right as parents to educate them as they pleased. And she was interrupted by a member of that committee who was a lawyer. He asked her, he says, "Lady, do you have a marriage license?" And she indignantly responded, "Well, of course I do." To which he stated, "Madam, hasn't anyone ever told you that when you applied for a marriage license, that makes your children wards of the state?" Listen to me, folks. What has happened is that one way the state has become the lord and master over married people is by the creation of licensing procedures. And I would suggest that the state, in usurping a God-granted right of the individual to marry, has in effect established itself as a god, and all gods have their subjects who serve them. This is not absurd. You only have to read Romans 6:16 to understand this concept. Remember Romans 6:16? "Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves as servants to obey, his servants ye are whom ye obey." And the idea here is that servants obey the laws of their God. And any time a person changes their law, they change their God. But normally we think of serving God as a voluntary thing. But not so with the state, as the state demands that we serve no one but the state. And so the state, or our new God, makes laws for its servants, being you and me, to obey, and they enforce this obedience of those laws through the police powers of the state. And through this insidious procedure, the state coerces everyone to serve it whether they like it or not. But from my point of view, such state requirements abrogate the people's right to the freedom of religion as stated in the First Amendment. And of course, I'm sure you're all familiar with that. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And that's what we're talking about here, the free exercise of religion. I've often said, you know, you can believe whatever you want to. The government doesn't really care. But when you start exercising your ability to, I should say, when it comes to prohibiting the free exercise thereof, if you exercise your religion,
and the state don't like it, they'll stop you from the free exercise of your religion. Now, with the passage of the 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights began to apply to the states, which means that the states are under the same general prohibitions as the United States. But even though this is true, we have been saying for years that you can believe what you want to again, but when it comes to this prohibiting your religion, they will prohibit you the free exercise thereof if you step out of line by their standards. Now, think about this. Think of the implication. The state also licensed churches and does so when the church applies for non-profit corporate status. And the corporate status makes that particular church one of the state's religions. And the result is the state is establishing a religion. It's the creator. We read that in the Hale versus Hinkle doctrine. And since the state has created the church, the state can regulate to its heart's content the activities of that church. It's just that the state, at this time, only moderately regulates its state churches. But by definition, and with its status as a corporate being, the state can even tax them out of existence if it chooses to do so, and that, my friends, is a settled issue of law. It's settled in the VC Bank case. Once again, the state has set itself up as a god by creating, among other things, this marriage license scam. And as I mentioned earlier, as a matter of law, what the state has licensed, the state can do whatever it chooses to do. It can force its licensed subjects to do its will. But again, by forcing religious people to get marriage licenses, the state also interferes with the free exercise clause of the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. Whew. I got a lot to get in here. I'm sorry if I'm going a little fast here, but taking a lesson from Scripture, we only need to look at the story about the splitting of Israel into two nations. Remember that? Jeroboam, the state, fearing that his people would go to Jerusalem to worship the true God and once again become loyal to a man called Rehoboam, he made two calves of gold, didn't he? Which were other gods. So he made other gods available to him, just like the state does. You know, you've had your God, you got married under God's auspices, but now we're going to issue marriage license permit and other requirements by the state, so that becomes the gold, these calves of gold out there. And the people worship them. They flock to the city halls or to the county courthouses or whatever to get these things, huh? In other words, Rehoboam, what did he do? He provided an alternative to going to Jerusalem, and everybody changed their God immediately. See how easy that was? And so likewise, our society has also become a body of people who at the founding of this country worshiped the Lord God and served Him. But now, since the vast majority of the population has changed their law, they now in effect worship the state. Romans 6:16. But people listen to me and laugh, they ridicule me, they do not accept this because they have been taught by the state churches that total obedience to the state is a godly thing to do. I don't think so. But please remember, if you change your law, you change your God. Those people have eyes and cannot see, and ears that cannot hear will obviously say that there's no cause for alarm in doing these things. And so therefore they're happy with their servitude to the state rather than God. However, those who can see and those who can hear may wish to stop serving Babylon. Or maybe we should stop serving, maybe we should say Mammon and get out of Babylon. Okay, a few more things here. We're running a little low on time. A marriage license entered into by mutual consent and without a state marriage license is just as valid as a marriage entered into with a state marriage license. And this is true because under the ancient customs of all civilizations, a marriage was considered valid upon agreement and consummation. And we've seen in the Bible that the literal definition, if we want to be blunt about it, is nothing more than sexual cohabitation, and you're married. But, you know, people like to have these ceremonies. It's something that we've been doing for generations. And if you want someone to officiate at a wedding ceremony, that's not really a problem. There's numerous preachers throughout the United States who will assist you in a ceremony if that's your desire. And if you can both sign a contract if you desire to do so, or if you prefer, they can provide you with a marriage certificate. But it will not bear the seal of the state. It will not be recorded at the county courthouse. Now, there are many disadvantages to an unlicensed by the state marriage. And most of these center around benefits from the state. For example, Social Security benefits for the wife of a deceased spouse is very difficult, if not impossible, to obtain. Obtaining medical benefits from a husband's medical insurance program may be another problem. And if your children do not have a state birth certificate, they cannot obtain a Social Security number, nor can they enter into public education system. Nor will a male child even be accepted into military service. Want to stay away from the draft? Hey, there it is, friend. No birth certificate, no Social Security number, no draft. You can't register. There are other disadvantages, and there are advantages as well, but it's not the purpose of what I'm getting at today is to enumerate on those things. It has simply been to show the history and the effects of a state-issued marriage license upon people who have those things. Okay, so I've went through an awful lot of legal material for you, and I think that we have seen the marriage license has been an impact on every one of our lives. But even more importantly, other than the things I have already mentioned, when we obtain a marriage license, it registers that marriage with the county, with the state, and with the federal government, just like it is when they do a census, just like it is when you have a property, transfer of property, that goes all the way to the federal level. And so, if a man were to marry another person and apply for another marriage license, he's already married, if he's going to marry another person, apply for a marriage license, then they have the evidence to use against you in a court of law if they decide to prosecute you for bigamy. And I know most of you men are probably not ever going to marry another woman, and so this is not going to make any difference to you. But the point is this. This, the marriage license, is just another way that government has of monitoring our activities and regulating and controlling them. Now, if we did not run to government and ask their permission for such things, they would never know who is married and who is not married. And actually, when you get right down to it, folks, it's simply none of their darn business if we're married or not. Did you ever think about that? What business is it to the state? Well, you want the benefits of the state, right? Here we go. If you want benefits, you got to apply for licensing. So being good slaves, we do what our master tells us to do. Now, if you've learned nothing else from this, I hope that you can recognize the mass intrusion the government has made into our private lives and the implications of having such things as marriage licenses. Well, that's it for today. But before I close, if you are a first-time listener and would like to receive information pertaining to this ministry, let me invite you to send for our introduction package. Please send your request to Gospel Ministries, P.O. Box 9411, Boise, Idaho, 83707. Don't put it off. Write for it today. That's Gospel Ministries, P.O. Box 9411, Boise, Idaho, 83707. To our regular listeners, I would like to remind you that Saturdays are prayer days around here, and at 9 a.m. every Saturday morning, that's Mountain Standard Time, we bring the needs of the people and the ministry before the Lord. So if you have a prayer request, be sure and send it in to us. And again, I invite you to join us at 9 a.m., for even though we are separated by long distances, we can still be together in prayer at the same time. Write to us if you're so inclined, as we do enjoy hearing from you, and many of you ask Bible questions which we are more than happy to answer by mail.